The Continental Can Company presents A Report to the Nation. With Lily Pons and Andre Castellanos just home from a U.S. tour overseas, the navigator of a B-29 that made a crash landing in China, CBS war correspondent Charles Collingwood, and Frederick March. This is a solemn hour in American history. In the greatest war of all time to guarantee human rights and liberty to the civilized world, this nation has lost a great leader. No man of our time has fought so hard to build a solid foundation for a secure peace. No man of our time has dedicated his life so wholeheartedly to those things which he found self-evident and right. Since 1938, our Report to the Nation narrator, John Daly, has known Mr. Roosevelt very well. As a White House correspondent, Mr. Daly attended presidential press conferences, went along on campaign trips, and followed the president on his tours of inspection of war plants throughout the country. His association with the commander-in-chief was a close one, and during those years, he saw a human side of the president that most of the rest of us missed. So we've asked him to tell Report to the Nation listeners now of the kind of man who led this nation to the threshold of victory and peace, John Daly.
A few hours ago, Franklin Delano Roosevelt returned to Washington, D.C. for the last time and passed through the ranks of grieving thousands along the familiar route from Washington's Union Station to Pennsylvania Avenue and up the famous mile to the White House. He had come from Warm Springs, which he called his second home, to the home that was his for so long because the American people wanted it so. Tonight, Franklin Roosevelt goes to Hyde Park, to the home which saw his birth and which now yields him gently to eternal sleep. Franklin Roosevelt, the man of flesh and blood, thus bids a silent farewell to three homes, all of which jealously claimed him as their own. In still another home, Franklin Roosevelt will always be enshrined, for even in death, he keeps his place in the hearts of all Americans, his faith and spirit keeping ever alive the will to seek out and find a better life and a better world. There will be men one day who will only know of Franklin Roosevelt because they will read of him in cold, unfeeling type. And they will wonder as they read what it was in this man who, with his passing, brought tears to the nation which was his own and cries of anguish from the peoples of other lands. And then as they read on, as they see, even in the cold black and white of the printed page, his testament, his legacy to his own people and all peoples, they too will take him into their hearts, regretting only that they could not know, could not see, could not hear him, could not hear that ringing challenge of 1933, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." And they will say, it is that. He strove to drive all fear from men's minds, and so there were tears and cries of anguish at his passing. But they will not know all then, only those of us who were fortunate enough to be close to him sometime, to see him with the humble and the suffering and the children, will know why there were tears and cries of anguish. As CBS presidential announcer and later White House correspondent, I came to be one of those whom Franklin Roosevelt called friends because his heart was big and there was room for all who worked with him or for him, who shared the days at his beloved Warm Springs and Hyde Park. My memories are thus richer than most. I will remember the hope that returned to the eyes of the polio victims at Warm Springs because he sat with them, swam with them, laughed them out of their fears, and gave them back to the normal workaday world from which they had run away in their bitterness and their pain. I will remember the plain workmen and the farmers who stood awkwardly by his car one moment and familiarly leaned on its door the next, happily talking about the things they wrought by their hands. And I will remember the surprise in their faces because of what they had done, and the murmured, "Why, he's just like you and me. He's a human being." And with you, I will remember the magnificent simplicity with which only a few weeks ago he begged the pardon of the Congress because he spoke to them seated, saying, It's a lot easier for me in not having to carry 10 pounds of steel around in the bottom of my leg. It was the first and only time President Roosevelt asked consideration for his physical affliction. Through the long years, especially in those days when he saw plainly what lay ahead, saw the dangers to which we were blind, and when we balked and refused to follow where he led, he must have known that if all the people knew how completely useless his legs were, he would gain an advantage. Because we, as a people, are emotional and sympathetic and kind. But instead, with his aides and Secret Service men, he played an elaborate game. They would gather around the president as he started to leave his car or to enter a building, and he would unobtrusively lock the braces on his legs and with one movement be standing by the side of his car, leaning on the arm of a friend. And his head would go up, and he would smile, and no one would think of his wasted legs or of his pain, and that would please him, and his smile would broaden. He gave unselfishly to his country and his people of everything that was in him. I last saw the president privately after I came back from Europe, a little while before last November's election. His eyes were bright, his grin was as broad as ever, and his handclasp was firm. But his face was drawn. His hands shook as they lay idle on his desk, and perspiration stood out on his brow, though it was a cool day. He must have known then that he was asking too much of his great heart, must have known that there was an end to even his endurance. But he went on through the strain of the election and on to Yalta. And there he poured his heart and soul, and I think life itself, into building the foundation of a world that he wanted for mankind in the years to come. On that foundation, we must help build the only fitting monument to his memory, a monument to last as long as mankind. We must build a peaceful world, a world in which there are 4 freedoms, a world in which there is no fear in men's minds. And his head will go up, and he will smile, and he will see what we have wrought in his name, and his smile will broaden.
Perhaps no American president has been better known to the American people than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Every American knew his familiar ringing voice. And so it's only natural that the entire nation feels it has lost a personal friend. For the reaction of American fighting men overseas to the death of their commander-in-chief, we take you now to Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
Sergeant Anastas Yannakopoulos and Sergeant Elenio Treviesos are typical of most of the GIs over here. Sergeant Yannakopoulos, how did you first hear of the president's death?
Well, you see, at the airfield where I am stationed, we have a loudspeaker system. At 6 o'clock in the morning at Reveille, they called the buzz over the speaker. That was one morning when everybody got up for breakfast.
How did the fellows take it? How did you feel about it?
I couldn't believe it at first. It just didn't seem possible. You could tell how everybody saw when we went to breakfast. Usually there's a lot of kidding and horsing around, but this morning everybody was quiet and sad. You see, he was about the only president we ever knew, that is, knew well.
How about you, Sergeant Treviesos? Is that the way your outfit felt, too?
Yes, it was. We felt... Well, you know how you feel when someone in your immediate family dies. You just don't know what to think. I believe the whole army felt that way. One thing I hadn't realized before was how much the president meant to the French. I'd been spending the night with some French friends, and when my buddy came to get me in the morning and told us the news, they felt as badly as we did. Later in the day, other French friends made a point of calling me up just to pay their respects, as it were. Then each of them asked me about President Truman.
And what did you tell them?
I had to tell them that I didn't know much about him.
I don't think any of us do. Out at the field, we're all asking each other the same question.
Well, what do you think, Sergeant Yannakopoulos?
Oh, we're all behind him. It's just that we don't know much about him. It's like when a new commander takes over the outfit. Everybody's in there backing him up, but they wonder what he's like, what kind of a guy he is, what he's going to do. That's the way we feel about President Truman.
Do you think that President Roosevelt's death is going to make much difference to the way we fight the war over here?
No, I don't think so. The army is such a big machine that one man's passing won't affect it. Anyway, nothing can stop us now.
How about you, Yannakopoulos? What do you think about it?
I think it will actually make us work harder and fight harder. The men in my outfit look at it this way. We consider President Roosevelt as a battle casualty. It was the war that killed him, and we hold the enemy as much responsible for his death as for any soldier killed on the battlefield. It's as if one of the big generals got it in battle. We'll fight harder to get back at him for it.
Does that fit in with the way you feel, Traviesa?
Yes, it does. As I said, we all feel it as a personal loss.
Thank you, Sergeants Yannakopoulos and Traviesa. I don't think there's an American soldier in Europe who doesn't feel as you do. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to Report to the Nation.
Americans at home hear a good deal about that gallant band of entertainers who go to the four corners of the world to give our fighting men a bit of music from home. What those entertainers do is a never-ending marvel to the men at the front lucky enough to see them. Not long ago, two USO entertainers landed at a field in India at dawn. The man was a musical conductor, his wife a singer. As their plane touched the field, they were still rubbing sleep from their eyes. And the first person they saw was Major Melvin Douglas.
Melvin Douglas, what a small world. How are you?
Okay, glad to see you. We better hurry. There's a lot of brass waiting for you at the landing strip.
But I'm not interested in brass. What kind of string section do you have?
Another field, another landing at dawn. It could be any USO tour, but these two entertainers have a very special meaning to report to the nation. They were our guests last August. 2 weeks ago on this program, you heard a part of a concert they gave for American GIs in the Rhine Valley within range of German artillery. Yes, they are the beloved maestro of CBS, Andrei Kostelanets, and his lovely, energetic wife, the star of opera and radio, Lily Pons. On this tour, their second for the USO, they were gone 4 months. They flew 40,000 miles. They saw your boys in China, Burma, India, France, Belgium, and Germany. They gave their 112th overseas concert before coming home. And here in our Report to the Nation studio to tell you about it now are Lily Pons and Andrei Kostelanets. How was your trip, Mr. Kostelanets?
To bring music to our soldiers overseas was our purpose. And to be able to do that made the tour an unforgettable experience.
I understand that you were the only artist to cover both the CBI and the European Theater of Operations on one trip. How did you manage to get around to so many places?
There was a great deal of flying in order to reach as many soldiers as possible. We made 62 takeoffs and fortunately 62 landings. In the CBI theater, we operated from central bases and flew every day to reach outlying camps and forward outposts.
And Andre and I were very surprised on one trip to find that our pilot and co-pilot were two generals. They were General LeMay and General Rainey, commanding officers of the 21st and 28th Bomber Command, which are now smashing Japan. They were great pilots. And they were coming with us so that they could attend the concert. Just before we took off, General LeMay said this to us.
General Rainey here is only half a good pilot, and I'm just a half good pilot. But the two of us together make a terrific flyer. We ought to get you there, okay?
Did your soldier orchestra fly with you?
Yes, in most cases they flew with us in bombers.
And where did you find your piano?
We carry it with us in the bomb bay, and it even flew over the hump with us. It was a great hit wherever we went.
Many of the soldiers hadn't seen a piano since they left home. I'll never forget our pilot pianist who played in our orchestra in India. You couldn't tear him away from it. He didn't even stop playing to talk.
Mr. Kostelanets, I've got some tough news. Here I've been rehearsing for a couple of days now. You don't know how much I've been looking forward to playing in your concert, but I guess I'm going to have to sit this one out. My name's posted today on the flight list. Tonight I'm out on a mission over the hump.
There were a lot of GIs who felt that way about music in the CBI theater. We felt as though we couldn't give them enough. And we felt the same way in Germany.
While you were over there, we heard that you were the very first entertainers to go into Cologne just a few days after that city fell. Mr. Castellanet, what kind of music did you play for the boys there?
First, I told them we were glad to be there with an orchestra made up of their own men. I said we had some music that hadn't been played in that part of the world for quite a while. And then there's some big American howitzer blasting away right beside us. For this part was only 3/4 of a mile away from the front line. We played the American Patrol. Inspiring to play that music with the howitzers almost a part of the orchestra. Our drums were supposed to be loud, but I never heard them sound so feeble. But in spite of that, it was a kind of triumphant music that went across the Rhine from the very soil the Nazis had called their own, but a few days before.
While you were over there, you must have grown to know some of our men at the front in Germany very well. How do you think they're feeling, and what do you think their thoughts are now that the war in Europe is racing at such a tremendous speed toward its victorious climax?
I know this. Those men were devoted to their commander-in-chief. With them, they believed in what they were fighting for. But this week brought tragic news. Perhaps the saddest part to them was knowing that President Roosevelt would not see the victory for which they have fought together so long. But I'm sure that they will fight harder than ever now to win that victory for him. And I am also sure that they will do all in their power to bring this world the peace of which he dreams.
This week, one of our reporters interviewed an Army Air Force lieutenant who told one of the best stories to come out of the Pacific Theater since the B-29s went into action. It happened last summer, but Lieutenant Jack Diamond of Cedarhurst, Long Island, hadn't had a chance to get home to tell it to anyone because he'd been missing in action from November to March. This is what he had to say.
I was a navigator on a B-29 we called the Windy City. We had just bombed Yawata at the tip of the same island Tokyo was on. Our target was the steel and iron works. After flying a couple of hours, we hit the China coast. We heard the engineer reporting on the intercom.
Used up more gas than we should thus far. That doesn't look so good.
There goes that pessimistic engineer again.
Yeah. Remember the mission last week? He was sure we could never make it home on 3 engines.
Yeah, and we flew 1,000 miles on 3, that's all.
We didn't think much about the engineer's first report, but he kept on giving us bad news. 500 miles from base, we were all getting uneasy. It didn't take much flying time to know that we were bucking some plenty tough headwinds. Our gas was getting lower all the time.
How's our fuel supply now, engineer?
We may be okay if we get a break on the weather. Looks like we can hold out till 22:31.
22:31. Looked as though it was going to be awfully close.
Jack, give me an ETA.
ETA, that's estimated time of arrival. That's just what was worrying me. My ETA is 22:31.
Well, that's a coincidence. Can you check those figures again?
I sweated over them, but I couldn't change them any. Still 22:31. I kept checking my ETA, but the headwinds weren't getting any better. The engineer kept checking the fuel supply. The picture didn't change. We were going to run out of gas about the same time we hit the field. We were going to have to be awfully lucky if we were going to make it.
We're running out of gas. We ready to bail out. Can you get the field yet, Bill?
Not yet.
Sugar Fox from 253. Repeat, Sugar Fox from 253. Give us a QDM. Over. Sugar Fox from 253. We're almost out of gas. We can't see through the overcast. If you don't give us that QDM in 10 minutes, we're bailing out. Well, here's another field, Major Gus. They've given me a heading of 335 degrees. 335. Okay. There it is, over there. The field beacon. Through the overcast, over there. Turn number four, engine is going down fast. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. Number four, engine's out. Okay.
We were dropping several hundred feet a minute on our way towards the field. But we couldn't get the tower on our radio. Other planes were circling the field, and we knew it would be suicide to try to break into their traffic pattern.
Co-pilot to all crew members, bail out.
Number one, engine is out. Okay.
Four gunners and the observer jumped from the right side of the plane. Major Gus, the pilot, tried to lower the nose wheel so those of us on the flight deck could get out of the hatch. But the wheel was stuck. The nose was down so far by then that there wasn't any other way out. I tried jumping up and down on the nose wheel. We all did. But it wouldn't budge. We were trapped.
Number one and number two engines out. Three may go any minute now. Okay.
I still can't get control tower. What's the matter with them anyway?
Airspeed's dropping fast now. 180. 170.
Nothing to do but go in and take our chances. We saw the field lights under us. We could only guess where the belly strip might be. We skimmed over a building, missing it by inches. And I saw the ground rushing up at us.
Number three engine, out of gas.
No power. The plane out of control. A dead stick landing.
Yes, the Windy City greased in on a dead stick landing at 10:30 at night when it was too dark to see the field. Major Gus set his B-29 down in the center of the belly strip facing the operations building in one of the neatest aviation tricks of this or any other war. Here in our report to the nation studio is the navigator of the Windy City, Lieutenant Jack Diamond, who grabbed a padded parachute seat, put it around his head, braced himself for the crash, and stayed with the plane. Welcome to report to the nation, Lieutenant Diamond. How do you feel about that trip?
We were awfully lucky, Mr. Daly. Awfully lucky. Getting that 29 in at night with a dead stick was one chance in a billion. And that's not all.
Isn't that enough?
Well, there were the fellas who bailed out. Our right gunner bailed out when the plane was so low that his chute didn't have a chance to open. It had just folded into his hands when he hit the only tree within 10 miles. Part of his chute caught on a branch and held. When he stopped falling, his feet were just a yard from the ground.
I see what you mean by lucky, Lieutenant.
But that's still not all. When the tail gunner bailed out, his chute opened just before he hit a house. The chute helped break his fall, and the roof did the rest. He dropped through and landed in bed with a Chinese and his wife. He wasn't even hurt.
How about them?
I guess they were surprised, but it didn't hurt them any.
Were any of the crew hurt?
Only one. The last man out fractured his leg. He bailed out just 200 feet from the ground, but his leg is healed now, and he's up and around again.
Well, for my money, that's the luckiest story of the war. And I'm sure that Report to the Nation's listeners join me in hoping that that luck holds forever.
There's just one thing I'd like to add, Mr. Daly. I know that the news from Warm Springs, Georgia, was hard for the fellas in the Pacific to take. But I also know this. There's not a man in the 20th Bomber Command who won't be giving everything he has to this war. Every man there knows that now, more than ever before, we've got to clean up that mess in the Pacific once and for all if we're going to have the decent kind of world our commander-in-chief planned for us. And that's the least that we owe to him.
This week on Okinawa, soldiers and Marines fought and died, building another stretch of the long road to Tokyo. Those who fell had fought and died for the same things as the 4,200 Marines who died on Iwo Jima, the same things for which President Roosevelt had sacrificed his life. When Iwo was taken from the Japs, when the battle was over and our dead were buried, A memorial service was held that will go down in Marine Corps history. This week, the first copy of that service to reach America was received by reports of the nation. And we think the nation should hear it, for this service might well be dedicated to our late Commander-in-Chief. And his name may well be consecrated by the same words that were spoken over the soil made sacred by those Marines who fell for the same principles, the same ideals as Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We have invited Frederick March, who is now starring in the Broadway production of Bell for Adano, to read from the Iwo Jima Memorial Service in its first broadcast on any network. Mr. March.
This is perhaps the grimmest, surely the holiest task that we have faced since D-Day. Under one of these Christian crosses, or beneath the Jewish Star of David, there may rest now a man who is destined to be a great prophet, or find a way, perhaps, for all to live in plenty, with poverty and hardship for none. Now he lies here silently in this sacred soil, and we gather to consecrate this earth in his memory. To this, then, our solemn, sacred duty, do we, the living, now dedicate ourselves. To the rights of Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, of white men and Negroes alike, to enjoy this democracy for which all of them have here paid the price. To one thing more do we consecrate ourselves in memory of those who sleep beneath these crosses and stars. We shall not foolishly suppose, as did the last generation of America's fighting men, that victory on the battlefield will automatically guarantee the triumph of democracy at home. This war, with all its frightful heartache and suffering, is but the beginning of our generation's struggle for democracy. When the last battle has been won, there will be those at home, as there were the last time, who will want us to turn our backs in selfish isolation on organized humanity, and thus sabotage the very peace for which we fight. We promise you who lie here, we will not do that. This war has been fought by the common man. Its fruits of peace shall be enjoyed by the common man. We promise by all that is sacred and holy that your sons will inherit from your death the right to a living that is decent and secure. Thus do we memorialize those who, having ceased living with us, now live within us. Thus do we consecrate ourselves, the living, to carry on the struggle they began. Too much blood has gone into this soil for us to let it lie barren. Too much pain and heartache to fertilize the earth on which we stand. We here solemnly swear this shall not be in vain. Out of this, and from the suffering and sorrow of those who mourn this, will come, we promise, the birth of a new freedom for the sons of men everywhere.
That, then, is this week's Report to the Nation. Report to the Nation is brought to you by the 25,000 men and women of the Continental Can Company. In Canada, Report to the Nation is brought to you by the Continental Can Company of Canada Limited. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.